Savitri is Ashwapati's daughter. How was she born? Why was she born? A world's desire compelled her mortal birth. Now what is this world's desire? Who took it to the divine? The whole of Ashwapati's yoga begins. And as a part of Ashwapati's yoga, you get the whole history of evolution. This goes on and on, so in one sense, you have a stop at the end of Canto 2, 9:30 time gets frozen for all this flashback. And where do you get the next canto after Canto 2? In Book 8. All this material between Canto 2 of Book 1 and Book 8, all this material about 500-600 pages is all a flashback. And because the action takes place after 9:30 of that morning, Book 8 has only one canto. And that canto is called, what is that canto called? You have the text. What is the number of that canto? It is called Canto 3. There is no Canto 1 and Canto 2 for that book. It's called Canto 3 because it has to come chronologically after Cantos 1 and 2 of Book 1. So,
this Canto 3. So all this has happened. So we are now going to Canto 3. The beginning of that day on which Satyavan was to die. This is page 14. This again, like the passage we read earlier, those of you who have lived with the mother, you can once again feel nostalgic, and maybe if you are attentive, hear her footsteps around you. This is the power that Sri Aurobindo's lines have. It's one of the most magical lines. Our Amal Kiran has called this absolutely mantric in their power. The lines I am now going to read. On page 14, about six lines from the bottom. Line 1, 3, 4. All in her pointed to a nobler kind. Talking about Savitri, all in her pointed to a nobler kind. Near to earth's wideness, intimate with heaven, exalted and swift her young, large vision spirit, voyaging through worlds of splendor and of calm, overflew the ways of thought to unborn things. Ardent was her self-poised, unstumbling will, her mind a sea of white sincerity, passionate in flow, had not one turbid wave. As in a mystic and dynamic dance, a priestess of immaculate ecstasies, inspired and ruled from truth's revealing vault, moves in some prophet cavern of the gods, a heart of silence in the hands of joy, inhabited with rich creative beats, a body like a parable of dawn that seemed a niche for veiled divinity or golden temple door to things beyond. Immortal rhythm swayed in her time-born steps. Her look, her smile awoke celestial sense. Even in earth stuff and her intense delight poured a supernal beauty on men's lives. A wide self-giving was her native act. A magnanimity as of sky or sea or sky enveloped with its greatness all that came and gave a sense as of a greatened world. Her kindly care was a sweet temperate sun. Her high passion a blue heaven's equipoise, as as might a soul fly like a hunted bird, escaping with tired wings from a world of storms, and a quiet reach like a remembered breast in a haven of safety and splendid soft repose, one could drink life back in streams of honey fire, recover the lost habit of happiness, feel her bright nature's glorious ambience, and preen joy in her warmth and colors rule. A deep of compassion, a hushed sanctuary, her inward help unbarred a gate in heaven. Love in her was wider than the universe. The whole world could take refuge in her single heart. The great unsatisfied Godhead here could dwell, vacant of the dwarf self's imprisoned air. Her mood could harbor his sublimer breath, spiritual, that can make all things divine, for even her gulfs were secrecies of light. At once she was the stillness and the world, a continent of self-diffusing peace, an ocean of untrembling virgin fire, the strength, the silence of the gods were hers. Now this is Savitri on the day on which Satyavan was to die. Now I have traced Savitri's birth, Savitri's childhood, Savitri's youth to the extent possible through Sri Aurobindo's lines. Now there comes the next phase, an important phase, which I am going to leave out more or less entirely, completely. This is the episode or the events that take Savitri to the verge of the forest where she meets Satyavan, and what transpires between them, and how they get married, and how they go, how Satyavan and Savitri live for 1 year in the hermitage. The last part of it, Savitri's yoga begins. And this is described in book 7 in some detail. Book 5, which is the book of love, which in its own right is a gem of a narrative poem, very dramatic in effect, very wonderful lines. Unfortunately, I have to leave it out because it doesn't correspond to the mother's life. Sri Aurobindo had this important, difficult task of reconciling the legend in Vyasa's Mahabharata, the Satyavan Savitri legend, and pack it with the significance he saw. He has said in many places that Ashwapati and Satyavan and Savitri were not just characters. They are spiritual forces which constantly are born according to the need of the time, according to the call of the time. In some ages they are recognized, some ages they are not recognized. Those of you who have followed, some people have interest in this, who was Sri Aurobindo in his past life, who was the mother, Mona Lisa, all this kind of thing. There is a great little science about this. Unfortunately, I am not interested in that science, because I don't think Sri Aurobindo was ever born before or he will be ever born again. Because Sri Aurobindo is a unique combination of several things needed for the earth drama at that time he was born. But there is something called Sri Aurobindo's spirit that takes birth, and it takes birth according to the needs of the time. So I am not saying Sri Aurobindo, that spirit that Sri Aurobindo symbolized, will not be reborn. But it would be wrong for us to claim that is our Sri Aurobindo. Our Sri Aurobindo came in body, did all that he was supposed to do, completed his task and left the body. So there is no point, no hope, clinging on, our Sri Aurobindo will come back. We have more than we need in the present Sri Aurobindo. Why do you want him to come back? Make the best use of Sri Aurobindo you have. And similarly, when the mother left her body, some people said, oh, the mother has left her body, so the program of supramentalization has been postponed. So we can all go back to sleep. This can never be true. Because the mother has come, if she is who we think she was, which is the Supreme Divine Mother herself, can't she take care of small little details? Like when, if she decides to leave her body, who will take care of the body? How will the body be taken care of? On the one hand we say, Tranamapi Nachalati Tena Vina, you are the Supreme Divine without whose consent not even a blade of grass can move. And here we are claiming, without her permission, without her sanction, her body was removed. I find these all incompatible. And it is also not true that the mother left the body without completing her mission. She has completed her mission. She doesn't have to be here to ask you and me for a certificate. Please tell me that I have finished my job and I am now going. We have to see what she has done. And you can see what she has done only if you have reached the point which she has reached. She herself has said once or twice that when Sri Aurobindo left his body, he didn't tell me that he was going to leave his body. He didn't give me instructions what I should do. But later, subsequently, she admitted he didn't have to tell me. He had left enough help at all the crucial points in my journey. His help was always there. So the Divine doesn't give you a kind of a blank check, look, I have given, made all these arrangements. You have to find it. That's your sadhana, finding the help the Divine has left. So the mother has done all the work needed for transformation. Whether you believe it or not is of no consequence at all. She didn't come here, as I said, to win a Nobel Prize or, you know, to be named as the greatest person on earth. That's none of these was her ambition. She did the work. If you want to convince yourself that she has done the work and the road to new matter is available, you have to get that far and see that that door is open. And we are where we are, and you say, we don't see the path. How will you see the path? You are here. And she was at the peak of the mountain. How can you see what she has created there? So in one sense, what I am trying to say is that Sri Aurobindo and the mother are not even Ashwapati and Savitri. They are unique. They came here, they did the wonderful work they did, and we have to be grateful for them for eternity. But when we talk about Savitri and the characters of Savitri, the story of Savitri, we must remember that this was an opportunity for Sri Aurobindo to pack Ashwapati's yoga with his spiritual experiences. That's what he did. For over 250 pages, you can't write about anybody else's spiritual experiences. Spiritual experiences are so unique, so personal. You can't write, it's not like writing a novel. Oh, I have written the longest novel in this language, 3,408 pages. It has to come from here. Sri Aurobindo said, I have recorded what I have experienced. So to experience, to write all this, 300-400 pages of poetry, spiritual experiences, they must be his spiritual experiences. And Ashwapati was a convenient framework. Sri Aurobindo was never born a king. And Sri Aurobindo had never a problem that he didn't have a daughter or a son. And his yoga was not for obtaining a son or a daughter. So Ashwapati has a different personality, has a different way in life, and Sri Aurobindo was different, but it was a convenient, from a literary point of view, it's a convenient peg to hang his coat on, as it were. A kind of a framework which made sense. Ashwapati also performed 18 years of tapasya, long enough tapasya, and at the end Ashwapati wanted progeny, a new birth. So Sri Aurobindo thought, why don't I use this symbolically? So what Sri Aurobindo was looking for is not physical progeny, but what he was looking for is that creative secret which will redeem humanity forever. Just as in the older days, people needed, they thought they needed progeny Otherwise, when they reach the Vaitarani river, you know there is a river called Vaitarani. At the end of your journey, you have to cross that river. And until you have your son here and he does appropriate rites, you won't get permission to cross that river. You get held back. Symbolically, the same thing has happened to us. Symbolically, we are held back at the impasse of the mental consciousness. Nobody is letting us go on the other side. We want to cross, we want to break the barrier, but nobody is allowing us. For that, you need a symbolic progeny, which is Savitri. And this is how Sri Aurobindo made use of the legend. But please, for God's sake, don't read the legend in Sri Aurobindo's life. Up to a point, you can interpret this, you can read the inner significance of it. It's true that Savitri, Ashwapati's yoga, is in a large part autobiographical. But it is not, the external circumstances are so different. Ashwapati was born, I don't know, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years ago. We don't even know. They say it's the elements of this occur in the Vedas. If they did occur in the Vedas, it must be at least 15,000 to 20,000 years old. And Sri Aurobindo lived in our midst almost. Born in the middle of the later part of the 19th century, lived through half the 20th century. And look at the gap. So there has to be a difference. And so Ashwapati's, Sri Aurobindo's aspirations can't be Ashwapati's aspiration. And yet, very delicately, he has tried to bring Ashwapati, tried to make him modern. In the earlier days, I was wondering when Ashwapati went to Cambridge, when he had all this understanding of the Western world, because it is Sri Aurobindo's understanding. But it is not jarring. You don't feel, you know, Sri Aurobindo has mixed up ages. It's there in a kind of delicate way. In Ashwapati's yoga, you have words like television. Television is belong to Sri Aurobindo's age. It doesn't belong to
Ashwapati's age.
So he brings the modern age, the modern aspirations. That's why it is of relevance to us. But we must remember that he was making use of an ancient myth for this purpose. And we should not try to identify Sri Aurobindo too closely with Ashwapati, nor Savitri too close with the mother. Because here, as you know, the mother was born in Paris, Savitri was a princess. Right? There's such a vast difference. She was born a daughter of Ashwapati, so 9,000, 10,000 years ago, this is modern. Savitri was born, the mother was born in 1878. And of course in Paris, because at that time it was regarded as the cultural capital of the world. Even now Parisians would claim that it's still the cultural capital, but this will be disputed now. But in those days there was no dispute. So she had to be born there, she had to bring to Sri Aurobindo's yoga the best that the West had thought, West had experienced. And Sri Aurobindo himself, as you know, was half formed in the West. He only came to India at the age of 21, 1893. And because he had the experience of the West so fully, so completely, when he discovered the East, he was thrilled. For us, East is too close to feel thrilled. It's in our garden. It's like a garden vegetable. Who cares for garden vegetable? You have to have an Australian pumpkin, then only it becomes a pumpkin. It's a golden in your backyard, nobody worries about it. So Sri Aurobindo discovered, Kalidas, Sri Aurobindo discovered the Upanishads and the Vedas. He said, look, what is it? When I was in Cambridge, I thought this is the best that the world has thought of, but here is something that exceeds all of this. This thrill. So the mother herself once says that modern young men should be first educated in the Western way so that they can discover what great things East has to offer. So if you really look at it in all these details, there are the number of differences between Savitri and Satyavan, and that is why, Savitri and the mother, that's why I think it's only the inner experiences that we should try to match or tally and not the external life. Because as you know, the mother was born in the West, she grew up in the West, She took the art world of Paris by storm. She married one of the artists. She went through the married life. She had given birth to a son. Now many Indians, you know, with stuffy noses, they ask, what is this? The mother had given birth to a son. These are unasked questions. Nobody asks them. And nobody answers them either. I am foolhardy enough to raise them and try to answer them as well. The mother had to do it. By doing that, she has freed all women. Just because you bear a child, you are not debarred from the supramental world. Whatever the world may say, oh, you have been, what is it, contaminated by the touch of sex, how could you now be claimant to the supermind? The mother says, sex is not something unholy. It is not something dirty. If you go about it the right way and then you can rise above it. The mother showed how to do it. Mother has written a play about it. And so, he met this artist. She had a son. She grew out of that marriage. This is quite common. Just as some souls go out of the body, because the body is left behind and the soul grows. Similarly, your life partner, whatever his stage was at that time, is left behind and you grow. And that poor man whom she had married couldn't keep steps with her. And the marriage doesn't have to be a shackle for life. There was a marriage, there was the experience, she is grateful for that experience. She brought up the child, then she moved forward, and then she said, I have to use this. The second husband she married was none other than one of the asuras. She said, the best thing is to keep these guys close to you so that they are not up to some mischief. She tried to change him. Look at the sacrifice she underwent. She was under great danger all the time. And, you know, he had great admiration for Sri Aurobindo. Well, Rishi had great admiration for Sri Aurobindo. But that admiration, like all intellectual admiration, stays here. That's all. It doesn't get down into life and in practice. And he also thought, mother also was like that. She probably write wonderful words. Paul Risha used to go around the world and say, the greatest genius, the greatest spiritual genius I have discovered lives in Pondicherry. Many of us have been saying that, but we do nothing about it. We probably come here 4 times a year, stay in international guest house at Goa. This is something, if you found a great truth, you have to live that truth. And when the challenge came, opportunity came for him to live, he ran away. And all this, the reason mother left Pondicherry in 1914, went back with Paul to Paris and then to Japan, trying to change him, trying to transform him. The mother is the mother of all. She is not only the mother of human beings, she is also the mothers of gods, and she is also the mother of asuras. She can't kill her children. Our understanding is so limited. Why can't she kill him? They can't be killed. They are eternal powers, and they will be there until you can transform them. Hitler can be killed, but the force that occupied in Hitler is still rampant, it's still going around. Then he has somebody else, then somebody else. What can you do? In the Puranas we have stories that certain Rakshasas can't be killed, because the minute a drop of their blood drops down on earth, a whole host of Rakshasas rise. That's the brood. You can't kill them. The only way you can do is to transform them. And no price is small for this purpose. And the mother kept Paul very close to her, trying to transform him. And by about 1920, when she came, within a couple of years, when Paul learned that mother, like Savitri, was determined to pursue Sri Aurobindo's yoga, Sri Aurobindo's path, he did his best to dissuade her, didn't succeed, and then went away. I won't go into other details. So, why did mother have to marry? Why did mother have to give birth to a child? Because by doing that act, by going through these experiences, she has assured women all the world that this is no bar. You can do this and still rise above this. Sex in the right way is not a sin, it's not unspiritual. But you can't mix this. Once you have turned to spiritual life, you can't say, I would like to have a little bit of sex as well. That's not done. That's not possible. Sri Aurobindo and the mother have said this very clearly. So, I think on behalf of all the women of this world, we must be grateful to the mother that she didn't remain a saint from beginning to end. This pristine purity. She didn't fall in love with anybody. She didn't give birth to a child. And therefore, how can we be that? We also have fallen in love. We also have given birth to a child. That will not be held against you. That's the mother's promise. If then, after this, you can rise. And so, to look at mother's life and match it episode by episode with Savitri's life would be wrong. Savitri, as you know, and Satyavan, in Sri Aurobindo's own story, the story of their love appeals to our imagination, to our aesthetics. But what did Sri Aurobindo see in Savitri? What did Sri Aurobindo see in Satyavan? He has said very clearly, Savitri is the grace of the divine, comes down to earth. And Satyavan is the aspiring soul of mankind. Aspiring soul of mankind which seeks perfection. That is represented by Satyavan. And so the love between Savitri and Satyavan is this, between these two. Divine grace and the soul of man aspiring. Now, this kind of love can hardly be called conjugal love, because on the one hand you have mother-like grace that descends. On the other hand, Satyavan, who represents human soul, he is going up. But the most ecstatic love human beings know is conjugal love. And therefore Sri Aurobindo begins at that point and then goes beyond it. So let us not imprison the mother in the image and events in the life of Savitri as we saw in the legend. Because there is a legend. In the legend, Savitri meets Satyavan. In the legend, Savitri marries Satyavan. All these things are there. And so let us stick to the legend and make the best use of it. And when everything is said and done, the book of love, Sri Aurobindo had written nothing else but just this book of love, he would have left for the English literature a most invaluable document of what love is, what love spiritualized can become. And so, I have spoken to you about Savitri's childhood, I have spoken to you about Savitri's girlhood, Savitri's youth. I will not go and match Savitri's meeting with Satyavan and the year they spent together and mother's life, because as I said, there are no parallels here. Because Savitri and Satyavan, as Sri Aurobindo himself tells us, represent, as I said, Savitri, the Supreme's grace, and Satyavan, the aspiring soul of mankind. I will read just that in the words of Sri Aurobindo, what he says in Savitri and what he has seen in Satyavan. And for him, they are not primarily a young princess and a young man falling in love. This is totally incidental. The framework had to be kept because this was Vyasa's story. He could not have rewritten Vyasa's story. Vyasa's story, he sticks to it, and yet, as I said, this is on page 702. The Supreme Divine now says, descend to life, middle of that page where you have the beginning of a new section. The Supreme Divine now, after Savitri has kind of triumphantly passed all the tests that he lays before her, is very happy with her, and he says these, descend to life with him thy heart desires. O Satyavan, O luminous Savitri, I sent you forth of old beneath the stars. I sent you forth earlier on beneath the stars. I sent you forth a fold beneath the stars, a dual power of God in an ignorant world, in a hedged creation shut from limitless self, bringing down God to the insentient globe, lifting earth beings to immortality. In the world of my knowledge and my ignorance, where God is unseen and only is heard a name, and knowledge is trapped in the boundaries of mind, and life is hauled in the dragnet of desire, and matter hides the soul from its own sight, you are my force at work to uplift earth's fate. Myself that moves up the immense incline between the extremes of the spirit's night and day. He is my soul, Satyavan is my soul, the Supreme says, that climbs from nascent night, that climbs from the darkness of the inconscient to the supernal light of timelessness, and my eternity hid in moving time, and my boundlessness cut by the curve of space. It climbs to the greatness it has left behind, and to the beauty and joy from which it fell, to the closeness and sweetness of all things divine, to life without bounds and life illimitable, taste of the depths of the ineffable's bliss, touch of the immortal and the infinite. He is my soul that gropes out of the beast to reach humanity's height of use and thought. When the animal becomes man, it is Satyavan who has advanced from the animal stage to the human stage. He is my soul that gropes out of the beast to reach humanity's heights of use and thought and the vicinity of truth sublime. He is the Godhead growing in human lives. Each one of us nurses in our heart a Satyavan who dreams, who writes poetry, who falls in love, who wants to change the world. But then he always dies an early death. Before your 20s are completed, you have become a raving, raging cynic. By the 40, Satyavan is gone. It is this Satyavan, to keep him alive, to make him active, the divine comes, Savitri comes, that's what he's saying. To reach humanity's heights of lucent thought, in the vicinity of truth sublime, is the Godhead growing in human lives and in the body of earth beings' forms. He is the soul of man climbing to God in nature's surge out of earth's ignorance. And who is Savitri? O Savitri, thou art my spirit's power, the revealing voice of my immortal world, the face of truth upon the roads of time, pointing to the souls of men, the roots to God. While the dim light from the veils, spirits speak, falls upon matter's dark, inconscient sleep, etc., etc. So we have to remember, therefore, Satyavan and Savitri are conceived one way, and as I said, they find manifestations. Would you believe there is a relationship between Purusha and Prakriti? Prakriti is the executive aspect, but that doesn't have always to be feminine. If you look at Ramakrishna Paramahamsa and ask who was his Prakriti ultimately, who made his force dynamic, it was Swami Vivekananda. All these distinctions of sex, male, female, etc., they don't coincide with the distinction between Purusha and Prakriti. And so this is a totally different level at which we have to see this relationship. Now tomorrow, since I have clarified this point, we will again go back to Savitri and look at her yoga, which is basically was Badar's yoga. We try to trace the footprints of the mother along the journey of Savitri as depicted in this epic. And we have seen that Savitri had to be there in a very big way, because Sri Aurobindo recast this epic in the form it is now, because he found that the mother was an incarnation and she had come down to bring for mankind a new consciousness. So in one sense, he was going to talk to us about the new consciousness, why it has to come, how it comes, and who brings it down. And he found the Mahabharata story, the legend, very convenient as a framework for this. But he didn't take too many liberties with the original story. He changed the story very slightly, but stuck to the original story. And an important part of the original legend is the event where Savitri and Satyavan meet, and Savitri decides to get married to him. This event, it belongs to the legend, and Sri Aurobindo keeps the legend intact. And as I said, book 5, the book of love, is built around this part of the legend. Now, as poetry, it's very great poetry, wonderful things in it, but I decided not to talk about it in any great detail because it has no correspondence with events in mother's life. It belongs to the legend of Mahabharata. And so we now skip the whole of book 5 and of course book 6, where Savitri comes and reports to her parents that she has found Satyavan and she has decided to marry him. And then Narad giving the prediction that this day returning Satyavan must die. All this we will skip over because there isn't much there for us to comment on, except the great determination Savitri shows, in spite of the fact that Narad has predicted that Satyavan has only one more year to live. She is unwilling to move from her decision. Now this strength of will, this capacity to remain undeterred no matter what the appearances are, was a feature of the mother. But this was also the feature of the great Savitri of the Mahabharata. In fact, what Narada admires about Savitri in the Mahabharata is her determination. He says, no matter what happens, I am not going to go out once again and look for another young man for my life's companion. I have found Satyavan and that's it. No matter what happens, I will take care of it. That determination, that inherent strength in her, of course, is characteristic of the mother as well. But here, it has become a part of that story. We'll skip all that and then come to the very beginning of Kant Book 7, which is called the Book of Yoga. Now, the original Mahabharata story talks about what is called a Triratra vow, a set of austerities Savitri takes up and practices for 3 days and 3 nights. Now just as Ashwapati's yajna is transformed into Ashwapati's yoga, Savitri's vrata, Triratra vrata, is converted by Sri Aurobindo into Savitri's yoga. And it is here once again we see an indelible mark of mother's life. So this yoga, which is described in 7 cantos, is basically mother's own yoga that Sri Aurobindo has portrayed. And this is where we catch up once again with our central character Savitri and try to see how much of it is corresponds to what the mother has told us about herself. Now, as we all know, Savitri is basically a narration or a description of 3 yogas. One is Ashwapati's, which is Sri Aurobindo's own yoga. The second is Savitri's, which is the mother's. Third, it's also our yoga, your yoga and my yoga. Because there we also come across the yoga of the earth, what it was in the past, through what stages it has now come, where it has now arrived, how man represents, as it were, the leader of this yoga, and where man has to go, how he will go. So it is not only the spiritual autobiography of Sri Aurobindo, it's also the spiritual biography of the mother, and it's also the biography of you and me, not the external life, but our inner life. Now, since Sri Aurobindo's yoga, or Ashwapati's yoga and Savitri's yoga are described here, as you can see, they can't be two different yogas, because the objectives are the same. The objectives are basically, as we try to characterize 2 days ago, acquisition or ascent to a consciousness which is beyond the mind, which is, he calls, supramental consciousness, bringing it down. This is only a means, this is not the end. The help of this consciousness to change all the instruments of our consciousness, which is mind, body and the vital, that's number one. And number two, make this siddhi available to the whole of mankind. This is the ultimate. But getting the consciousness, bringing it down, etc., are only the means towards this end. So, since the end is the same, you can't expect different goals for Sri Aurobindo's yoga and the mother's yoga. They have the same. But they are different people. They are different, two different individuals, and they will not be following exactly the same path. Even if they are avatars, they have slightly different paths. Now, it would be an interesting study. Someday somebody will have to undertake it and say in what respects Ashwapati's yoga is different from Savitri's yoga. In what ways there are similarities, in what ways, in what respects there are differences.
Thank you.